Hello, and welcome back to another new episode of the Roadside Couch podcast. My name is Drew Cheek, I'll be hosting, and today we're going to be talking about Portal 2. This is a game produced by Valve Corporation. You can find it on as many consoles as PlayStation, Steam, as well as Xbox, Microsoft produced games. And yes, we're going to be talking about that today. So this game follows, it has two, it's Portal and then Portal 2. As we know, Valve isn't known for pumping out a third game in any of the series that they are so famously known for, Team Fortress, as well as Half-Life. And so the game follows Shell as she explores and proceeds through the tests that are given by Aperture Science Labs. This is one of the high-end facilities that you are led to believe exists in this universe, which has been noted to exist alongside the Half-Life universe, but never with any significant crossover outside of Easter eggs, which, if you are unfamiliar with, are small little hidden bits of information or signs that you see throughout a game that reference something outside of the crucial information that you find in a game. Now, Shell begins in the her little containment cube, as it were, and she is asked by the instructional AI, artificial intelligence, that is running these experiments, GLaDOS, to proceed through a number of tests as she gauges Shell's capabilities in regards to, solving certain little obstacles and an attempt to make it to the end of the suggested room and then proceed to the next test. As far as you can tell, Shell is, in the eyes of this artificial intelligence, GLaDOS, just a kind of lab rat, and throughout the story and the game, you learn certain things about the character Shell, not very much, but more importantly, you learn things about Aperture Science, the way it runs, and why it is Shell is going through these motions. As I feel compelled to mention, there are going to be spoiler alerts, so if you are intending to play this game for the story value, please, please stop here, go out and play it, and then come back to me, because I wouldn't want to ruin any of the really, I believe, quite interesting story that you gain. And it's more so in Portal 2, but in the first Portal, you do get sort of the building blocks for the universe that you wind up growing to enjoy in both of these games. The biggest and kind of titular part of this game is that you do, in fact, use a device called a portal gun. It allows you to create two differently colored portals. In the case of Portal 1, it is a blue one and an orange one, you know, opposite colors, so that you can really differentiate them. And you create these portals so that you can hop into one and come out the other. This can be used in a variety of ways, involving lasers, moving particles through the air that you have to have land at a certain destination, being able to jump through one and down onto another, being able to place objects on them so as to control buttons and certain other variety of things. And as you progress into Portal 2, having the capability to transport either liquids, such as fluids that make you go faster, or have certain levels of bouncing capacities, as well as giving you the opportunity to put convection tunnels through, which move you through the stages, and quickly changing them so that you can A, fly through them, which is one of my favorite things to do in the game. You put a portal in one spot, you jump into the other portal, and it kind of flings you through using momentum. And there are a variety of different ways that they ask you to use these portals. And as you play through the game, as I said, they introduce certain themes in reference to A, the facility, learning and figuring out why exactly Aperture exists and what your goal is, as well as determining, you know, how am I going to fix this puzzle? How am I supposed to get from point A to point B? And I can tell you there are a certain number of puzzles where it took me a while to figure it out. Now, in Portal 1, it's much more basic. You're just kind of solving the tests. And while you do find yourself at the end getting a bit more story in the fact that you at some point are going to be taken out, or rather eliminated, by GLaDOS because she no longer has any need for you. You've completed all of the tasks that she sees need of you for. And in this moment, you are compelled to eliminate GLaDOS as an enemy. And you go through these certain set of motions, and in the end, you utilize cores, which are other artificial intelligence, but in this case, each of these has some sort of flaw. So in GLaDOS's case, she's somewhat, I would describe her as psychopathic, in the sense that she has no moral obligation to keep you alive. She only sees a need for you in that you are doing her a service in completing these tests for her scientific gain, so that she can gauge to what degree you as the lab rat kind of serve a purpose to her. And so in the end, you of course are no longer crucial to her findings, and therefore disposable. And it's your job to use these cores, which are each some form of flawed device. They describe them as artificial tumors. You know, so one of them may just constantly be spewing about space. Just, he's the space core, has a yellow eye, and he's one of the fonder of them in Portal 2, and he's constantly talking about space, how he wants to be in space, how he wants to live space. And there are a variety of other cores, each with their certain dialogues, all with some sort of obnoxious theme to them. And in Portal 2, you're introduced to a core who's trying to help you out. His name is Wheatley, and his goal is to get out of Aperture. He wants out just as much as you. And so he's your best friend in Portal 2. Well, in Portal 1, we're stepping back so that we've got some context. You have made your way through completing these tests. Like I said, there were some where you had to land on buttons, and each time, once you completed the test, you took an elevator, which, as far as you can tell, is taking you further up the facility, getting you out of this subterranean science lab that you've been kept in for a time that you were unfamiliar with. And as you make your way through, you finally get to GLaDOS, and GLaDOS is intending to end your life, and so you take it upon yourself to apply these tumor cores so as to lower her capability to take you out, and in this way you take her out. Following that game, you are seen leaving the facility, and it just kind of goes blank there, and it plays through a cute little tune in which GLaDOS sings a little song of sorts to you about how you have done this whole process with in killing her. One of the major points of trying to get out of this facility is a running joke that you may find out in media outside of just the Portal fandom, and it is that the cake is a lie. GLaDOS, on numerous occasions, offers you cake, saying that this is kind of your goal. You're working towards this cake. And if you did a certain set of jumps, squats, and what have you in the original game, you actually had the capability to break into a room where there were a bunch of cores stored on shelves, and in the middle is this cake that you've been told about from the beginning. And as well, they show it at the end of this game. At the end, you know, kind of through all these tunnels and ways that you wouldn't, or rather aren't supposed to be able to get through unless you are one of those folks who figures out all of the little patches that the game designers couldn't quite cover. Well, this running joke carries over into the second game as well, and is one of the most iconic themes of the game that you want to get to the cake, but alas, the cake is a lie. Well, one of the other funny little themes of the game is this companion cube. Like I said, there are objects you use to weigh down these buttons, and in the case of the first game, they also involved orbs, but in the, as well, there was cubes, and these are weighted cubes that are supposed to be able to, sometimes you gotta fling them places, and they hold buttons, you use the convection tunnels to keep them there. And there are a number of different ways that you utilize them, but at some point you come across a particularly special cube in that it has hearts on it. It's known as the companion cube, and you're led to believe that it has some sort of sentimental value outside of the normal cube, that this one has been endowed with a personality of sorts, and that it cares for you, and you should care for it. And there are a number of ways that you can try to sneak it out in both the first and the second game, trying to hold on to this companion cube. You want to keep it with you. It's yours. You know, he's your friend. And as far as you can tell, Shell has no other connections outside of this companion cube and Wheatley in the second game, for as long as you consider him a friend. And so, through this, you find this companion cube to be your pal, but inevitably, each time, Gladys figures out a way to dissolve the cube from you and take it from you, because she's kind of playing this psychological torture game as she watches you run through these mazes and loops and hurdles. And she isn't the only person or being that you interact with in these games. There are also the turrets. The turrets are these pill-shaped white little robots with red lasers that point in the direction that they face, and they stand on a tripod of sorts for their legs. And they speak with these soft, sweet little voices telling you, "Are you still there? Where are you?" And once they start firing, of course, they're significantly less friendly. But they give you this impression that they're supposed to be little sweethearts. And being that you have this portal gun, which is a device that is capable of more than just portals, you're able to pick things up with it. And so that you are able to get the cubes, the orbs, as I had said. And in this case, you're actually also able to pick up the turrets. Well, in picking up the turret, they immediately start firing. And so you're actually able to use the turrets to fire on each other, which is just goes way, way, way against any moral structure that these robots would have had. But alas, there you are in a fighting position, and you're going to take any and all obstacles out because you want to go get the cake. The cake isn't a lie in your heart. And so they're a fun little bit to the game. And in Portal 2, which we'll begin talking about now, you are reintroduced to all of these themes that were in Portal 1. You see all the same robots. You see Gladys later as you progress into the game. You are introduced to a couple new themes, though. And you begin in this one, waking up in a different kind of home. This one seems more of a long-term facility. It's supposed to have rehabilitated you progressively, but you find that you've awoken mute because you've slept for thousands of days longer than you should have. It's a kind of funny theme where, like, things went wrong. The facility got shut down because you took out Gladys, and so everything went a little womperjaw, and Wheatley finds you. He's the one that wakes you from your slumber. And in his infinite wisdom, which I say quite sarcastically, he decides that you're going to move your room up to this other test room so that you can begin making your way through the facility to try and get the two of you out of there. He has led you to believe that he was kind of your caretaker. He was in charge. And so you follow him blindly because, you know, he's the first person you've seen, or a first being that you've seen since you've awoken, and so he has to be the safest. You proceed through there, you do a couple of these tests, it reorients you into the game that you're playing, and as you make your way through, you find the derelict kind of body of what was once Gladys. Well, in his continual misadventures of trying to take over or regain some form of power in this facility, Wheatley advises you to turn on a switch of these thousands of switches that span the wall. And in turning on the switch, you immediately make your little, the place where you stand begin to rise and flip on every switch, which, if you can kind of piece together what that might mean, it turns on Gladys. Gladys is now reanimated, alive, and in that moment realizes that it's you. You're back again. You're playing the same character that was from Portal 1, and for whatever reason, you've woken this being that is hell-bent on either testing or killing you from its slumber. And she is, a little chapped because she's been dead and reliving the same moment over and over again of when you did it, and B, ecstatic to see you because look who can do some more testing for her. And you're plunged right back into the nitty-gritty of it. Well, following this little misadventure, you are led to continue through these tests. And as you are, Wheatley will appear to you in different points of it. All of the rooms that were previously clean are now grown over with different plants and different, no fauna, just flora. And as you play through, you notice that Gladys has been slowly but surely cleaning it up, fixing up the facility, trying to put more comprehensive facilities together so that it looks more workable and less broken. And as you proceed, of course, Wheatley's still hell-bent on getting the two of you out of this facility, Aperture. You make your way through this way and that way, and you notice that in this second game, you're able to go places that were previously not available to you in the first game. It's seen less so as just plain white and unvarying, but more as an actual facility that someone used to be in charge of. This seems less perfect, less controlled. And you can tell that she hasn't been around to maintain the facility and to keep it running at its maximum potential. While going through these motions of trying to make your way out, Wheatley finally gets an opening, and he says, "We're going to take it. We're going to get to her, and we're going to take her out." In the process of trying to take her out, you decide that the best possible solution is to put Wheatley where she was, not knowing, and this is where the spoilers get heavy, that Wheatley loves the power, and in this moment decides to, turn Gladys into a potato battery experiment-style AI, so she's essentially just attached to a spud, and that's what's keeping her powered, because as you see as you're walking through, there was a science fair in which some of the scientists who were previously alive in this facility before all hell broke loose had their kids come in and do a science fair, and he noticed that one of the spuds that had been used for this classic potato battery experiment had become a giant plant that, as far as you can tell, is one of the biggest reasons why the entire facility is overgrown. Upon attaching her to it, he decides that you fully intend on taking him out, because you had taken her out, despite the fact that you were the only reason he's in the position to be able to take over the facility. And in this moment, he plunges you and the potato Gladys, as we'll be calling her, into the depths of Aperture. This is one of the best points of the game, because you're facing a turning point that you would have never had in the first game. The first game was very lateral. You went the same direction, you wound up at the spot, it was done. But in this one, you've just plummeted into this derelict facility that hasn't been used since what they kind of reference to be the 60s, 70s era. You're learning things about like how they were going to the moon, how they were doing all these what now we would call older experiments, but then were just innovations. And this is where you're introduced to one of the human characters of the game, Cave Johnson, the founder of Aperture. Now, Cave Johnson has a very special place in my heart because I think he is one of the funniest characters I've ever heard in a video game. He is a corporate man who is looking to innovate in any way he can with all of the best scientists and, at the beginning, all of the best patients. We'll go with the word patients. I'll come up with a better one later. He offers up to have, like, these astronauts, these, like, hardworking Olympians show up, and they're going to be the subjects of some of these tests. And as you progress through these lower parts, you're introduced to things that they experimented with that were prior to when big name Aperture, the one that you were familiar with from the first game, this kind of modern one, what they had experimented prior to that. This is where you learn, like, when they first started tinkering with how they were going to work the portal gun. You find out that the reason the portal gun it works is because it is shooting onto a moonstone type of surface, which is why everything you have seen up until then is this kind of whitish texture, and those are what you're capable of putting the portal on. While there were concrete walls, metal walls in the old games, you couldn't utilize those. It's only in this game, or it's only on these white surfaces that you're capable of projecting your portal, and then, of course, propelling yourself or walking through to your other destination. It's down here as well where we first see the propulsion gel and the repulsion gel. The propulsion gel is orange, and in this one, it allows you to go faster. If you shoot across it, you will go with a great speed, and in this way, you're able to launch yourself through these portals much quicker and with greater distance and arc. The blue gel, the repulsion gel, does exactly what you think. It repulses you in a way that you bounce. So if you fall from a great height, you will bounce up to a great height. The same way that if you just jumped on it, it would only really allow you to jump a little bit higher than you already could. During this little adventure down in the depths of Aperture, you are learning about all of the new kind of aspects of the Portal game, and as well, you're learning about the history of Aperture. You're learning about why Cave Johnson does the things he does via mandatory audio that comes through the game, as well as optional, like I said earlier, Easter egg styles. So there are on the walls all of these doors where you imagine other experiments occurred, and there are audio comms next to them where you can click and listen to the recording of what likely happened in there. So, for example, one of them is about how there was an experiment that they did in which they gave some of these subjects praying mantis DNA to try and see if it would, like, heighten their abilities. And then, like, a door over, it's Cave Johnson going, "Hey, if you showed up to participate in this praying mantis DNA experiment, sorry, we're no longer taking applicants. However, if you're interested in making a little bit more money, go into this door, grab a gun, and start taking out mantis men in a way that it's clear the experiment went wrong, but he's an innovator, and he's ready to pay you just a bottom line dollar to do the thing." As you progress upwards through this aperture, you find yourself learning all of these new things about how he innovated, how it was moonstones that did this, and how all of a sudden he's getting sick, things are going downhill for him. And of course, you found Potato Glass along the way. She had fallen down, you were lost from her, but for whatever reason, you heard her at one point getting attacked by these birds because she's attached to a potato. You attach her to one of the prongs on your portal gun, and therefore she's with you, and as she listens to Cave Johnson, you, for whatever reason, get to hear Gladys referring to him with great admiration for whatever reason, probably because he was an innovator, a scientist, and she, also an innovator, is drawn towards that kind of person. But you're noticing that for some reason, they have a connection beyond that. And as you progress through, of course, you learn more things about the story. And the furthermost of them is that she is the consciousness of his secretary, who he held in great esteem. See, he comes to be sick because of the moonstones and all of the radiation or what have you that he's been inhaling, and that they're going to be unable to cure him. And so he says, if you can't put me in there, put Carolyn in there. And so what happens is you are led to believe that Cave Johnson dies, and in his place, Carolyn is put inside of this artificial intelligence and becomes kind of the consciousness that is behind this maniacal, robotic caretaker of the facility of Aperture. And in this way, you kind of see the morals being built into GLaDOS. She's getting more three-dimensional character, less two-dimensional, psychopathic. And this really builds into the story how the characters of Aperture, while they seemed so very obvious, had more dimensions and had more layers to them. As you move up through the levels, you even move through the decades. So you go from this more 70s aesthetic into this more 80s aesthetic. And you also hear about how Aperture was less interesting to people as it had been back in the day, when there was this more awe to science. And now it's become more normalized. And so they're asking homeless people to show up. They'll get fed. They'll get a pair of shoes. All they got to do is participate in an experiment. And I think there's even one where they replace all of their blood with lead or something. And it's just, it's wacky and bonkers. And in one of the most interesting Easter eggs that they do, they make a reference to Half-Life, in which there's a submarine of sorts. And he says, I made that because I'm going to challenge Black Mesa, which is the facility from Half-Life, which is a zombie-related game. I haven't played them very much, but it's interesting to see how Valve has even kind of made call-outs to itself. Well, as you make your way back into this out of the ancient facility where only Cave Johnson is kind of regulating the experiments from the grave, essentially, through these pre-recorded audio messages, you make your way back into the core facility where GLaDOS had previously been in charge, and where Wheatley is now just smashing rooms together, throwing experiments together, and learning that there are reasons outside of just a drive to learn new things that compelled GLaDOS in these ways. There is the fact that she actually had a kind of sensory response to when Shell completed a test properly, that she got a synaptic pleasure from it. And Wheatley realizes this because he's trying to get these poorly tossed together turrets to perform actions that he finds to be kind of to solve these puzzles for him. But he gets this like minor euphoria from it, but then it's fading, and each time he does it, he realizes that there's less of it. And GLaDOS, of course, who's had it this way for decades, as far as you know, is fine with it. But of course, this guy, who's kind of an idiot and a maniac, doesn't know how to process the fact that he can't get this euphoria, that he's got all this power but nothing to do with it. And so when Shell arrives, he understands why GLaDOS loved her so much. It's a human test subject. They can solve these tests, unlike the robots, which are just kind of going through their own motions. As far as he knows, that's the case. And so he goes through this little fight here and fight there with Shell, and you manage your way through, going through these bizarre new tests that he's tossed together, and finally, you wind up in a position to where you're having a very similar battle to that of GLaDOS, but in this case, he is totally fine with wrecking the facility, unlike GLaDOS, who was more concerned with maintaining it. And so he's just burning the place to the ground, and you've brought in tubes to try and change this, tubes to try and change that, and all the while, much like in the first game, he's trying to kill you, using, which I omitted earlier, neurotoxin. He wants to poison you. Gladys tries to do it in the first game. Hell, Gladys tries to do it in the second game. And Wheatley is like, yeah, neurotoxin, that's the way to kill him. Just quick and easy. So it's your job to figure out a way out. And upon getting to this final battle with Wheatley, you're attaching cores such as the Space Core. I think one of them's kind of like an adventure core. He's green, and then there's a purple kind of passion core, I believe. And he is wrecking this facility, and finally you see an opening in the air, and it's the moon. And as you learned earlier in the game, the moon is kind of the surface for portals. And so you place a portal down on the floor and another portal up on the moon, and all of a sudden the vacuum of space is trying to suck you out. And it does successfully suck you out into space, but someone catches you. And you're brought back in, and as you awake, there's Gladys, who has remade her facility, as well as two new robots, who were named Atlas and Peabody. We'll go into them a little bit more. But she explains that she saved you because through your misadventures, the two of you down in the depths, you have become a little bit closer, and she says, I care about you, and then deletes that part of her memory because caring about people is a weakness. But being it that you technically brought her back to life, saved her life, and then brought her back to her facility, despite being the one who put her in the position to have all of that happen, she says, instead of having to deal with a nuisance she didn't realize could be so overwhelmingly hard to deal with, she would rather you were just gone. And so she gives you the exit, and you get to listen to this beautiful little turret opera, and upon exiting, you find yourself in this kind of a wheat field, corn field, and you're alone. And then you hear a rumbling from the elevator, and what does she let you have? A dirty companion cube. Now that's the story from the second game, and most of what you would get from the first game. But I feel I should dive into a couple more of the Easter eggs of the second game before I get into the co-op, which is the more innovative part of the second game outside of this expansion and its story. So one of them is the Rat Man. You notice in this second game that there are a bunch of scribbles and scrawls all over the walls. There's even a spot in one of the early levels in which you can hear some music playing, and it's I won't be able to remember the name of the song now. I think Exile Vilified or something, and it's kind of following the scientist that observed Shell when she first experimented, and how she was able to kind of liberate the facility of Gladys, who had become egomaniacal and taken out all the scientists because she didn't need them anymore. She was the only scientist that the facility would need. And he was a survivor, and he glorified Shell. She's kind of this great being, you know, a goddess to him, because she took out this monster of a robot that he wasn't sure could be taken out, and she was capable of taking out because of her just strong will to get that cake, which wasn't a lie. And so you see all these different murals to Shell, and stories of the first time she finally fought, and stories about this and that. And in the end, during that final cutscene of you going through the elevator and passing through all of these levels, as you near the exit of Aperture, you see, if you watch very closely, a silhouette of a rat man running in the background, and he's one of the more fun Easter eggs of the game. As well, I had said earlier that there's a song that Gladys sings at the end of the first game. She also sings a song at the end of the second game. These kind of wrap up the theme of the game. But in the first game, it's this... I'm not going to be able to remember the words, but you find that it's playing on the radios of the second game. You can find these radios in these little Ratman dens, or what they're called, were back in the tucked away cubbies of the maps where GLaDOS will even yell at you for going because you're supposed to be paying attention to these tests. You know, that's all you exist for her. But you're curious, like a little monkey known George. And you want to know what these things are because, you know, Easter eggs, that's half the reason I play games, so that I can find the stuff that they hid away in the game. Another one is not really an Easter egg, but just a funny from the Portal 2 when you're down in the dank dark of the old aperture. You see the aperture logo change. It's the loading screen, and so like there's the basic one that you're familiar with, and then as you go into the deep, it goes into this retro 70s style label, and then you go further up and it turns into a more 80s style refined label, and then finally you wind up and it's the Atlas label, but it's been or aperture label, and it's been covered over with Wheatley instead, because he of course is full of himself and the narcissistic orb, and he wants the facility to be named after him. But another one of the funnies is Cave Johnson talks about when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, and he says, I don't want your damn lemons. Take your lemons and I'll turn them into lemon grenades. And it's just this bizarre concept that, like, he's not going to do the normal or the ordinary. He's extraordinary. He's Cave Johnson. He's an innovator. He's going to reshape the world in his image, and it's going to be cooler than anything you've ever seen. And that's one of the fun parts of the game. Well, following this is Portal 2's co-op, which is one of the innovations they made when they made the second game that the Valve Corporation made. They're the ones who made Half-Life and made Portal and made Team Fortress 2. And what they did in this one was they gave you the ability to play with someone else, which kind of reshaped the abilities of you, because now you had four portals at your disposal, not just the two that you get from your gun. You could play with someone else, and now you can shoot through like four different portals at once. And this offered you the opportunity to play as the characters Atlas, who is a circular kind of figure, and he uses they make these little robot noises, and you can like wave at your partner and give him like high fives and stuff like that. And then Peabody, who's orange, unlike the blue Atlas, and his is more of a pill-shaped body, and so they've got different shapes to them so that you can differentiate the two. And throughout these tests, they're supposed to be the replacement for Shell, and you play through very similarly to the second one in its cleaner graphics and more advanced puzzle types, but the first one in the fact that everything's been kind of cleaned up, except that at the end of each of these, GLaDOS, for whatever reason, has Atlas and Peabody participate in these outside of the test chamber kind of missions of sorts, in which you're going through these back channels of the facility trying to find certain things for GLaDOS. So in one case you find a CD, in another one you're flipping on a switch, in another one you're finding your way into a new facility, and as you're doing this you're opening up new avenues and like new ways that you're going to be changing your play. So like the hard light surfaces, the convection tunnels, the different types of propulsion and repulsion gels, making them more readily available to your characters in these kind of proceedings. And as you go through this, you're noticing that she will talk to them in a somewhat familiar individual sense. So, like, she'll say, Blue, I think you're doing a really good job, or, couldn't help but notice that Yellow was carrying the team in that last one. You know, just these real backhanded ways that she speaks to the robots, just the same way she did to Shell, always making fun of her weight, the fact that she was a mute, or the fact that she had no parents. And to some, she would be considered just the absolute worst, maybe even considered the B word, but I find it quite endearing that she kind of despises them to the degree she does, or has such a low opinion of each of them. And it keeps score, you know, on like how much you did this or how much you've done that. But more or less, you're working together as Atlas and Peabody, despite the fact that GLaDOS implies that you're enemies. And you go through each of these portals. Like I said, you're walking through these back channels. And in the end, you wind up at these birds. And, you know, in the earlier single-player campaign of Portal 2, these birds are kind of the enemy to her. You know, she hates them. She's got a vendetta. She doesn't want any part of what they're about. And so it's funny to see her getting mad at these birds who have now had eggs. And then she winds up kind of endeared to them, you know, like, this was her enemy, but now it's like, what am I gonna do? I'm not gonna kill these birds. Like, they're here, they're staying. But you do find your way back into her room, and you realize that the reason she had Atlas and Peabody going through all these motions was there was an entire section of this facility with a bunch of cryogenically stored bodies. And you know what that means? New test subjects. So it's kind of fun because then it plays this little tune that, you know, it's, I think it's called like Turret Party or something, and it's real chipper, you know, and it shows each of these folks getting scanned in, and that's kind of how they play the credits for that part of the game. And it's a nice little, it's cool that they made a story for A, the single player, but that there was an entirely different story built for the co-op mode of the game. Now, like I said, they didn't ever make a follow-up game to these. However, they did make, or rather not Valve, but another group made a third installment to the game series called Portal Stories Mel, and it follows a new character, not Shell. It utilizes a different type of gun. This one is what you can tell to, you believe it to be kind of the prototype. It's yellow. It doesn't look as refined and cute as the white one that Shell utilizes in her Aperture adventures. And it takes you through these different stages that kind of go differently to the others. I've only ever played through this one once, and so I'm a little less familiar, but you're kind of being aided by this new core who, as far as you can tell, is a good guy. And honestly, I don't even remember if he was a bad guy. If I'm remembering correctly, he was a nice core trying to help you through the whole shablingo. And instead of GLaDOS being in charge, it's this different kind of, I believe they refer to it as like the spider AI or something, and it's just maintaining this part of the facility. And much like these other two games, you progress your way through, but this one was nice in that it didn't follow Shell. It was a new person, it was a new core, it was a new enemy, but it used a lot of the same mechanics that were in Portal 1, as well as introducing, I believe, one new style of mechanic where you could like ride something or what have you. And it also had all of these fake things in it. It was as though they had tried to make it look like an inhabitable environment, but it was clearly fake. They were trying to like fool the inhabitants into believing that they were outside or that they were able to live in a capacity that wasn't just subterranean. Now, Portal's Reach didn't stop with Valve, or rather their core games. There have been lots of ways in which they've been implemented into other mediums. So one is that there was a Line Rider-esque style game made based on the instructional videos that you see in the Portal games. They would pop up onto the screens as you would get into the elevator in 2, and they involve these little stick figure looking guys who would proceed through or explain to you what the different or the new machines did. So like you'd see these little stick figure style guys utilizing these convection tunnels improperly and then properly, or they'd show you neurotoxin and why it was bad, or why you shouldn't jump on propulsion gel, or rather why you shouldn't eat propulsion gel. And they made a game or app, I think you can get it on numerous different types of consoles as well as mobile, And it's kind of a line writer, you know, you've got to build the room the way it's supposed to be utilized, and that does the thing. But it wasn't the only bonus game that has been kind of made. One of them that I found really cool is a part of a core game called LEGO Dimensions. In LEGO Dimensions, there are numerous worlds. To say that there was only one would be absolutely wrong. The core game follows the characters from the LEGO movies, so like Wild Style and Emmett and all of them. But more specifically, Wild Style. Batman from that same universe, or from the LEGO Batman universe. And then Gandalf, I believe, is the third one from the LEGO Lord of the Rings universe. And it follows the three of them as they are trying to kind of keep the whole LEGO universe together. Because all of the evil characters from all of the different universes, for whatever reason, have come together to try and take it all down. And that's kind of its own podcast and long-winded story, but in this game you were able to buy DLC content in the shape of these LEGO figurines, and it would give you full worlds and in some cases entire playable like stories or levels for your game. So in the case of Fantastic Beasts, you'd build a set that went on top of the primary LEGO set, and it gave you an entire playthrough of Fantastic Beasts. Whereas in the case of like the Goonies, which is a bizarre one that they also involved, it was just the world of the Goonies. And while it did show you each of the different aspects of the movie The Goonies, it wasn't fully playthroughable stories, or in some cases they'd give you like one level. So like in the case of Ghostbusters, there's one level that plays through all of the story of Ghostbusters, whereas in the new Ghostbusters, which they also included, you got a full story of it. It was both the world as well as a like I think 10 level plot. This was neat in the fact that Portal got one, and it also had some playthrough value. A, it was utilized in the main story, and B, you got a world that had all of Aperture, and that was kind of neat, because you could do different things that were involved with the story, and you could interact with these characters, and of course you could play as Shell, which allowed you certain opportunities within the core game itself, because much like those that involve DLC, there are certain things you couldn't do in the core game without these DLC pieces, which to some would feel like some money gouging, and I'll grant you that it kind of was, but in my case, I was so enamored by the game that I was more than willing to shuck out so many dollars to get as many of these worlds as I could. In the case of Portal, of course, though, you were playing like a LEGO version of the game, and I think that's one of the cooler things that they've made, you know, LEGO Portal. It was just two mediums that I never thought would like cross over in that sense. Another of the accessible games that you could get is through it's this automated pinball game. I play through on Xbox, but I imagine that it's on others, and it's called Pinball X3 or Pinball Deluxe or something like that. But in it you can get different tables, so like there's Star Wars, there's Marvel, there's I think one that's just all adult cartoon style, so like Family Guy, Bob's Burgers and those, Aliens, Alien versus Predator, there's the core games that they have on there, which could be like Spartan Carnival, any of those like silly themes. And then as well, for this game, there's a Portal 2 table. Now, I dedicated an unruly amount of time to trying to figure out this table because I very much enjoy the Portal series, so of course I was going to combine my love of Portal and my love of pinball into one thing. And in it, you can do on any of these tables a certain set of missions to try and get to this like big score. The same way in a normal pinball table, there might be certain buttons you clicked that would allow you to do special things on them, the more advanced tables, not the old-timey ones. And in this one, it would be such as tests, like you were trying to hit through or go through certain hoops and hurdles with your pinball as a means of trying to get Shell through these portals and tests in the game. And one of the fun things you could do is, in many of these pinball games, if you went through the same lane numerous times, sooner or later you trigger something by either filling out a name or what have you. And in the case of this game, it was Atlas and Peabody's names. And if you got both of them, you got the multi-ball, because, you know, multiplayer co-op mode. And when it did that, much like when you would complete the co-op game, it would play that turret party theme. Or you could go into the turret facility if you hit the bumpers a certain number of times, and it kind of mimicked how you had to go through the turret facility on Portal 2. And it made numerous callbacks to the other games. Heck, there's, I think, the gaining an extra ball, you had to, like, get a hold of Wheatley, and he'd just hang out there with you. And it's a neat way that the game, while a franchise built in Valve, managed to reach its arms outside of just there. Another aspect of this game is, of course, the fandom. They've created all sorts of merchandise. You can get Aperture vests, you can get Aperture pants, you can get Aperture t-shirts, Aperture tank tops, and you can try to dress yourself up like Shell. You can get Aperture, you can get the portal gun. I think back when Hastings still existed, rest in peace, you could get a portal gun there. And that's just, yes, it's not going to create an actual portal, because if science had created that, I would have already flung myself through it. But you could, you know, if you're into cosplay and stuff, make yourself into Shell. Like, I had the potato Gladys, and how it worked was exactly what you think. It utilized a potato, and then you took two metal plugs, the Gladys, which had a battery attached, and it powered Gladys, and she'd talk to you and say stuff. And then the merchandising of it, though, has reached further, and the game, of course, has stretched its legs out past just the regular what you'd expected of it. And so I would strongly recommend the Portal franchise if you haven't played any of it. There's lots of availability. Like I said, there's Xbox, PlayStation, Steam accounts, and these different variations of playability allow you a lot of opportunities. And then I strongly recommend the co-op of it, because I think there's something to be said about yelling at your buddy to place the portal correctly when you've flung into the wall so many times. You know, that really strengthens bonds. I know me and my sister aren't allowed to play that game together anymore because of how much we yelled at each other. But I think there's something to be said about a game in which you are reliant on each other to complete the mission, and that you can't play the co-op alone. Trust me, I have tried to play through it before on my own, and maneuvering two different characters at the same time with two different controllers is a task that no one should be put up to. So, if you enjoyed this commentary, please, please, please feel free to listen in again, and I would strongly compel you to go hunt down and play Portal. It has been out for so long that I believe you can buy it for like $6 on Steam. And $6? Like, that is nothing. And there's DLC. I know that now they allow you to make your own maps on Portal 2. If you have enough software space, you can make your own. You can find ones that have already been made. That's one of the glorious things about Steam, is that they knew that mods were a thing. They were like, Gary's Mod freaking made it, my man. We gotta go. We gotta get more of this stuff. And so, like, games like that I've spoken about before, Binding of Isaac, all sorts of DLC, gamer-made content that you can apply to your games and just give it a new dimension, and Portal is one of those. And like I said, Portal Stories Mel, if you've already played through Portal 1 and Portal 2, I strongly recommend seeking this one out. Yes, it's not the same story. I don't even believe that it's the same people, but it's new content, and it's still that home-style Portal. It's still following a character who's making it through, trying to get through these puzzles. And one of the best parts about the game is the difficulty of these puzzles on first glance. Now, yes, if you've played through them a billion times, they're going to be easier because you already know what you're trying to do. But on first playthrough, they make for good puzzles. You really got to think outside the box on some of these. I know in one of the co-op missions, you had to fling yourself constantly through a loop of portals, and your buddy had to shoot you up long enough for you to hit a button, then drop you back down, and they had to replace that portal in another spot quick enough for you to click a secondary button. And that one took us like 10 minutes to figure out because it's just that advanced, and they've just spun it so much into this new kind of concept. So if you like that stuff, please seek it out. And if you like anything along those lines, Valve really does push out some good games, and of course Steam's the same cousin, which is why I attribute the two. But you can also get them on Xbox and on PlayStation, and there are ways that you can adapt Xbox controllers to utilize your laptop if you'd rather play with a handheld controller but only have a laptop to play on. So if you liked all of that, please stick around for another podcast, or rather not stick around, but go hunt down another one of my podcasts. I've talked about Binding of Isaac, I've talked about Bit Heroes, which is a mobile app game, and I've talked about, I can't think of it. I've talked about other games, but if you liked what you heard, please tune in again on our next podcast. I think I'm going to be talking about Borderlands 1, specifically only 1, because Borderlands 3 just came out, and I know that that is a very, 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 very exciting topic, but also significantly too fresh for me to start spoiling. But Borderlands 1 has been out since like 2011 or something, so I can talk about that one as much as I want. Please, thank you, all of those things, for tuning in, and I will see you again, or rather hear from you again, or you'll hear from me again in the next podcast. Thank you for tuning in to Roadside Couch Radio, and if you like 60s, 70s, or 80s music, please tune in at bakerradio.org to Roadside Couch on Sundays, 6 to 8 p.m. My name's Drew Cheek. Thank you so much.